5 was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting another massacre in Pakistan. A gun and bomb attack on a university campus in the country's northwest Wednesday killed at least 20, including 18 students and two teachers, and wounded dozens. The military says a group of four terrorists stormed the Bacha Khan University in the town of Charsada. They were all killed. Nawab Khan, father of one of the students at the school, said there were rumors about an attack on a school in Peshawar. He says these attacks should not happen. They are having an adverse impact on children's education. It's unclear who was responsible. A Pakistani Taliban spokesman denounced the attack, saying it's against Islamic Sharia. More than 150 were killed at an army school attack in December 2014. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan Wednesday, at least seven journalists were apparently targeted by a suicide bomber in Kabul. The bomber detonated explosives near a vehicle owned by a company that works for Tolo News, Afghanistan's first 24-hour news channel. The channel had been threatened after reporting on alleged Taliban abuses in its attacks last year on the city of Kunduz. Tunisian police Wednesday clashed again with protesters demanding jobs in the city of Kasserine, a second day of protests following the death of one unemployed man. Witnesses say police used water cannon and tear gas while groups of protesters erected roadblocks and threw stones. Protester Mohammed Qadari said the demonstrators are defending their right to work. The only way to be heard are clashes. Late Wednesday, the government promised to create thousands of new jobs. The North African country has been plagued by high unemployment and poverty since the 2011 revolution that toppled longtime President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. This is VOA News. Uncertainty over the timing of talks on Syria's future and the humanitarian crisis there were high on the agenda Wednesday as U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met with his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, in Switzerland. The meeting comes amid heightened concern that Monday's scheduled start of UN-mediated talks and a political transition is in jeopardy. Mr. Lavrov says he has no thoughts about moving the start time of the talks to next month. He expressed confidence the talks would get underway this month. Mark Toner is a U.S. spokesman.
Our expectation is that the talks will take place on January 25th. Those are UN-led talks. It's really for the parties involved to reach agreement on who will participate in those talks. But we still want to see them take place on January 25th. And I think it's the Russians' sentiment as well. You, of course, have to ask them. But clearly, that's the date we're still looking toward.
There is still widespread disagreement over which opposition groups should be represented at the UN talks. Officials say the meetings next week cannot proceed until there is a mutually acceptable list. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter and six allied defense ministers agreed in Paris Wednesday to step up their military campaign against Islamic State. The meeting followed the removal of IS fighters from the Iraqi city of Ramadi last month.
We agreed that we all must do more. I believe today's discussion gave every minister the opportunity to discuss with their governments what else they can bring to the table and how they can better align their efforts with our common goals and strategy.
The defense chief announced that 26 ministers will meet next month in Brussels to talk about military operations against the IS group. The U.S.-led coalition says its airstrikes hit an Islamic State cash collection point this week near IS's northern Iraqi stronghold of Mosul, destroying tens of millions of dollars the jihadists were using to pay fighters. U.S. Army Colonel Steve Warren said Wednesday that Monday's attack was the second strike in Mosul against an IS financial target in as many weeks. He said it's impacting their ability to pay their fighters. The mystery of the poisoning death of ex-KGB agent Alexander Litvinenko may be solved Thursday when a British judge releases the findings of his inquiry. Litvinenko died nearly 10 years ago after he was allegedly poisoned by a cup of tea laced with polonium-210, a rare radioactive isotope. The former Russian intelligence officer has been an outspoken critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Moscow has always denied any involvement in his death. Zimbabwe's Constitution Court Wednesday outlawed child marriage involving girls under age 18. The case brought by two women forced into child marriages. One-third of Zimbabwean women have said they were married before 18. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa. From the Voice of America, I'm James Batte in Washington. Today's Thursday, January 21st. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Burundi's government says it welcomes the visit of the UN Security Council delegation.
We expect that in Burundi, they will find that all the information they have been getting from abroad or from some social media or websites were completely wrong. That in Burundi, we are living at peace.
Willie Damitwe is senior advisor to Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza. Margaret Bashir will report on the UN Security Council delegation's visit to Bujumbura today, Thursday. South Africa is urged to stop the abuse of migrant farm laborers. And an opinion poll says President Yoweri Museveni will win Uganda's February 18 presidential election by 51%.
Selection of respondents remains random, and distribution of samples to different sub-regions was proportioned to population. So you'll find that a region with a high population in Uganda had the highest number of interviews conducted.
Patrick Wakida is the Chief Executive Officer of Research World International. Zimbabwe's constitutional court outlaws child marriages, and the United Nations sees a slight improvement in world economic growth. Those stories plus Marco Woman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A UN Security Council delegation is expected to arrive in Burundi today with a message for the government and opposition to start substantive dialogue and avert catastrophe before it is too late. VOA United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir is traveling with the delegation and filed this report.
It is the second time the council has visited the country in less than a year, a clear indication of its growing concern over escalating bloodshed. Election-related violence has killed at least 439 people since April, and more than 230,000 have fled the country. Human rights violations are on the rise, and the country's economy is collapsing. U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power, who is leading the mission along with her French and Angolan counterparts, told VOA that Burundi is at a crossroads.
They cannot let it become business as usual, that you wake up in the morning and there's a corpse on the street as you try to get to work. And that is what is starting to happen in Burundi.
Observers fear that the violence sparked by what is seen by many as an unconstitutional third term for President Pierre Nkurunziza could result in another civil war between the country's ethnic Tutsis and Hutus, similar to the one that plagued the country from 1993 to 2005. Angola's UN Ambassador Ismael Gaspar Martins says the council is going with a clear, united message to the parties about the urgency for a real intra-Burundian dialogue.
That we want Burundians to engage seriously in a dialogue which can bring the country out of this, you know, situation. We see this as the only way to, you know, come out.
During the council's brief visit, they will also discuss options for a larger UN political presence in the country, as well as an African Union proposal to send a force of 5,000 troops to Burundi to prevent the eruption of violence. President Nkurunziza has so far been adamantly opposed to that option. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The Burundian government says it welcomes the visit to Bujumbura by members of the UN Security Council. Willie Nyamitwe, senior advisor to President Pierre Nkurunziza, says the UN delegation will discover that everything the international community has been hearing about the crisis in Burundi is all false. He says the country is living in peace as it tries to disarm those who are working to disturb the peace. Nyamitwe's comments come as a delegation from the Security Council left Wednesday for Burundi with a message for the government and opposition to start substantive dialogue and avert a catastrophe before it is too late. Nyamitwe says the people of Burundi have already started talking to each other through the inter-Burundian dialogue.
This is a kind of fact-finding mission. So we welcome everybody who needs to come to Burundi and witness how far we've gone with the consolidation of our national unity and the building of our peace. So we expect that in Burundi, they will find that all the information they have been getting from abroad or from some social media or websites were completely wrong. That in Burundi, we are living at peace. but we are trying to disarm some individuals who tried to disturb the peace in our country, but that who are, have been completely defeated.
Where does this report come from about mass graves?
Those of mass graves are being investigated by justice in Burundi. We cannot neglect any information. If people are accusing the security forces that there are mass graves, justice has to make investigations. So we are waiting for the results, but this issue will be addressed properly.
When you say justice, you mean the Burundian justice, or would you welcome outside investigation?
We have to trust Burundian institutions. We've got institutions. But the problem of some African countries is that they even not trust themselves and their own organizations. So in Burundi, we have institutions that can investigate and address issues of the kind properly.
The issue of African Union forces. I think some members of the Security Council would really like for the African Union forces to come to Burundi. Your government has said that you don't welcome that. Do you still hold that position?
It's in a no-go area. The population of Burundi has said these troops are not needed. We trust our security forces. We trust our soldiers that they can protect the country borders. They can protect the civilians in Burundi. And so far, they have never been defeated. All the attacks from the inside or outside the country have been defeated within 2 or 3 days.
What happened to the peace process?
The peace process is on in Burundi because even yesterday, we have launched a session of peace talks in Burundi in a province called Kirundo. So this inter-Burundian dialogue, these internal dynamics have started again. So people of Burundi are talking now.
The opposition, FRUDEBU, is your government willing to negotiate with them, to talk with them?
The government is not negotiating with no one. We are talking about dialogue, inclusive dialogue. So anybody can be part of this dialogue as long as it's according to the 2248 resolution of the UN Security Council.
Mr. Nyamitwe, so nice to meet you, and thank you very much for coming on Daybreak Africa in person, not on the phone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
and I wish you a happy new year.
Oh, a belated happy new year.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, my brother. Willie Nyamitwe is senior advisor to Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza. He spoke with me yesterday in our Washington studio. In Uganda, the latest opinion poll released by Research World International shows incumbent President Yoweri Museveni of the ruling National Resistance Movement will win the February 18 presidential election with 51% of the total votes cast. Dr. Chisa Besigye of the main opposition Forum for Democratic Change is in second place with 32%. While independent candidate and former Prime Minister Patrick Amama Umbabazi is third with 12%. Patrick Wakida, Chief Executive Officer of Research World International, tells reporter Peter Clotty that the poll was scientifically conducted and that it is a true reflection of the situation on the ground ahead of the presidential, parliamentary and local elections.
We conducted this poll between the 19th and the 6th, and we interviewed close to 2,700 respondents across the country. This poll has a marginal error of plus 5, minus 5, which is attributed to a number of factors. One is there is quite a lot of fear among the voters and suspicion. You know, Uganda now has got too much government across from top to bottom. So when we did attribution of how much fear it would have been, it brought us within those margins. So the service given is a confidence of not less than 95%.
How scientific is your polling?
Any poll done with us is very scientific. Selection of respondents remained random, and distribution of samples to different sub-regions was proportional to the population. So you'll find that originally the high population in Uganda had the highest number of interviews conducted. And you also find that the majority of the interviews were conducted in the rural areas, because in Uganda, most of the people live in rural areas. Again, you can see that majority of the interviews were conducted by illiterate or semi-literate population, because that is the structure of our population.
What this represents to me, and I think other people, is that we can see the level of boldness with which voters have become. You know, given that there is too much government in Uganda, when you see people within the ranges of, you know, 1 to 30% saying, yes, if elections were held today, I would vote on opposition, then probably basically the defiant campaign is taking root, but also that the number of opposition has increased.
I've heard some opposition figures sharply against the outcome of your polling, basically saying that this is a pure publicity exercise for both President Museveni and the NRM, particularly when President Museveni failed to show up for the recent presidential debate to tell Ugandans what he intends or plans to do for them. So this is just a mere publicity exercise for them. What do you say to that?
If I was his handler, I would never have allowed him to go for a presidential debate, because he would have been the focus of the debate. He's the incumbent who has been in government for the last 30 years. So probably he felt he feared to be fired, questioned by the other guys. Two, he feared to be made the subject of discussion.
Patrick Wakida is the Chief Executive Officer of Research World International. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from Uganda's capital, Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 21st. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's send a shout out to listeners on our affiliate station, Kira FM in Jinja, Uganda, and Radio Lake Victoria in Kisumu, Kenya. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. Solidarity Center and other migrant labor organizations are calling on the South African government to urgently intervene and stop severe labor rights abuses faced by thousands of migrants who are working on the country's farms. As Tuso Kumalo reports for VOA from Johannesburg, thousands of Zimbabweans who fled economic meltdown in their country are being mistreated on farms in northern South Africa.
Zimbabwean national Thembani Ndlovu has been working at the Johannesburg farm in the northern province of Limpopo for 8 years. He describes his employment at the farm as a job from hell. He works 7 days a week for 18 hours a day, but is earning only $120 per month. This is 50% below the stipulated $240 per month for farm workers. He and other Zimbabweans are temporarily housed at Disaster Management Center in Limpopo after they were brutally assaulted by their employer with the help of fellow farm owners for demanding an extra 59 cents a day for the extra hours they are working. Lovu says on the day they were evicted from the farm, their employer teamed up with neighboring farmers and unleashed dogs, tear gas, and rubber bullets on them. He angrily says that even animals deserve better sympathy than they got from their employer.
All of us, we are human beings. We are Africans. They must not treat us as if we are animals. Even the white people, they are supposed to be told we are human beings and we need equal rights.
Solidarity Center Programs Director Peter Hardy wants the government to urgently put a stop to the abuse. He calls for South Africa's Department of Labor to do more in protecting undocumented migrants and to ensure that farm owners pay the wages stipulated by the law.
The laws are there. The biggest challenge around most of this is just inability to enforce what exists on the books.
Janet Mnakamwe from African Diaspora Workers Network says migrant organizations want the government to deal harshly with the Johannesburg farm owner as a deterrent to abuse.
The socioeconomic rights of workers being trampled on, treated under very slave-like conditions. The employer actually confiscate the documentation to limit mobility. Not going to allow this farmer to get away with it this time, such that we deter this particular commercial farmers from whatever they've been doing.
South Africa has been the first choice of thousands of African migrants fleeing war and economic difficulties in their home countries. Rights organizations say even more migrants could be coming due to worsening economic conditions and drought in many African countries. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Zimbabwe's highest court has ruled that marriage before the age of 18 is illegal. The unprecedented ruling by the Constitutional Court followed an application by two women who sought to have the legal age of marriage moved to 18 for both men and women. Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare.
The case was brought to the court by Loveness Munzuru and Rimbotsopodzi, two young women who were just girls when they were married and gave birth for the first time. Lawyer and former finance minister Tendai Biti represented them and on Wednesday described the ruling as court historic and revolutionary.
The court should be congratulated for taking such a bold, bold decision. I feared that they would leave that to the legislature. So I'm very pleased to be part of this history. Parliament should have done this many years ago. They had over 36 years to do it. They didn't do it. So it has taken a bold decision from a bold court to do this. So it's a great day for women.
BT, who is now a member of the group Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights, said celebrations would not last long as the country has to come up with penalties for those who ignore the court ruling. Zimbabwe is one of the four Southern African countries with the highest rates of girl child marriages, according to the United Nations Population Fund and the Development Group Plan International. The others are Malawi, Mozambique, and Zambia. The organizations say early marriages prevent children, especially the girls, from developing careers, forcing them into a cycle of poverty. Clemens Charwe, a marriage counselor, held Wednesday's ruling.
It's the right decision that the Constitutional Court has made. For me, especially nowadays, you really need to be sure what you're doing, because you find the issues of divorce and so forth beyond the high side, also because of people who just jump in, not fully understanding what a marriage is all about. And when you're in there now, you then think, oh, maybe this is not what I really wanted, or maybe this is not the person that I really wanted. So if someone is over 18 and you're looking at maybe around 21 and so forth, for example, it's an age where you can really, with your full senses, make a decision. Say, yeah, this is the person that I want, and this is the right time for me to get into a marriage.
Poverty, religion, and tradition are main reasons for child marriages in Zimbabwe, where more than one-third of girls are wed before they turn 18. The UN Population Fund calls child marriage a violation of human rights. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
The United Nations says it foresees a slight improvement in world economic growth over the next 2 years, following last year's less than stellar performance. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva at the launch of the World Economic Situation and Prospects 2016 report, jointly published by the UN Conference on Trade and Development and the UN Economic Commission for Europe.
The world economy grew by a mere 2.4% in 2015. UN economists say they expect a modest improvement over the coming 2 years, with global growth reaching 3.2% at the end of next year. The UN's joint report predicts growth in developed economies will continue to gain momentum this year, surpassing 2% for the first time since 2010. It says developing and transition economies are expected to do even better, with growth rates reaching 4.3% in 2016 and 4.8% in 2017. It says East and South Asia will remain the world's fastest growing regions, despite the slowdown in China. A senior economist at the UN Conference on Trade and Development, Alfredo Calzano, says China continues to significantly contribute to global growth despite its economy's downturn. He tells VOA he believes the world's reaction to the economic slowdown in China is exaggerated.
What we are witnessing is something normal and desirable, in the sense that the new rates and the new modalities for growth are more sustainable, because it's a slowing down to 6.9%. It is not a slow growth. It is a growth important enough to provide a stimulus for the global economy.
Calzano says China will continue to be one of the engines of the world economy for the foreseeable future. The report says the European Union is now the driving force behind world trade growth. It expects the gross domestic product in the region to grow to 2% this year and rise slightly in 2017. It finds Southeastern Europe will continue to benefit from low oil prices, accelerating growth over the next 2 years to 3%. UN economists warn that geopolitical risks could have a negative impact on business confidence and be disruptive to trade in the European region. They say unresolved tensions in Ukraine and its deteriorating economic relations with Russia, as well as the conflicts in the Middle East, which have created the migration crisis in Europe, could have a depressing influence. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with football. Striker Zakari Yannick Krahire scored at the stroke of halftime to secure Ivory Coast's victory by a solitary goal against Morocco at the Orange African Nations Championships in the Amahoro National Stadium in Kigali, Rwanda, on Wednesday. Earlier on at the same venue, Rwanda edged Gabon 2-1 in the other group a tie. Midfielder Ernest Sugira scored in each half for Rwanda as Aaron Salim Bupenza scored for Gabon in the second half. The victory strengthened Rwanda's position at the top of Group A with 6 points. What's more, Rwanda is the first team to secure a place in the quarterfinals. Ivory Coast lies second with 3 points, while Gabon and Morocco have 1 point each. Today, Thursday, the spotlight shifts to the Huye Stadium in Butare, some 140 kilometers south of the Rwanda capital, Kigali, for Group B fixtures. First up is the Democratic Republic of Congo, who engage Angola. A Congolese victory will see them qualify for the last eight. In the second match, Ethiopia need to win against Cameroon to get their campaign back on track after losing their first group tie. Turning to handball, a clash between defending champions Algeria and hosts Egypt looks set to be the highlight on the opening day at the Africa Men's Handball Championships in Cairo today, Thursday. Gabon face Morocco as Cameroon play Nigeria in the other Group A matches. In Group B, Angola play Kenya, Tunisia engage Libya as the Republic of Congo encounter the Democratic Republic of Congo. The winner of the 10-day contest earns direct passage to the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics in Brazil, while the top three teams qualify for the 2017 World Men's Handball Championships in France. In basketball, Cameroon and Nigeria get another chance to qualify for the women's basketball contest at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics during the Olympic qualifying contest from the 13th to 19th June in Nates, France, the World Basketball Governing Body FIBA revealed in Mize, Switzerland. Nigeria and Cameroon are among 12 teams vying for the 5 places up for grabs to Rio de Janeiro at the tournament. Senegal qualified for the Olympics when they won the Africa Women's Championships in Yaounde, Cameroon, last September. Draws for the men's Olympic qualifiers will be conducted next Tuesday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has blamed thieves and politicians for undermining the military's fight against Boko Haram militants. That's it for this Thursday, January 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Dave Magnus, I'm James Butters saying have a lovely day, Africa.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. And 2000